You are about to participate in an exciting verse-by-verse Bible study. This program offers an exegetical, historical, grammatical approach to the Bible. Our host, pastor-teacher Bob Utley, tries to corroborate his teachings from five areas: word studies from the original languages, grammatical construction, context, parallel passages, or historical and cultural insights. This is one of the several series that Bob teaches weekly. Get your Bible and let's begin our prayerful study of today's lesson.
Hello, we're continuing our study in Acts. We're going to be in portions of Acts 23, 24, and 25 that basically deal with Paul as he comes to Caesarea by the sea, the Roman headquarters of the occupation forces of Palestine. Now, I'm going to pick up the last part of 23. Most divisions start with 24, but I want to see him getting there. Now, the plot has been revealed by Paul's nephew, has been told to the Kiliarch. The Kiliarch has sent him along with a lot of soldiers. Whether 470 or 270 is uncertain, but a lot of soldiers, foot soldiers and cavalry, took him by night. Now, if we pick up in verse 31, it says they brought him by night as far as... Now, this town was named after Antipater, and we're not exactly certain where it is. It's between 30 and 40 miles from Jerusalem, which leaves about 25 or 30 miles on to Caesarea. Some say it's too far for soldiers to walk in one night. It is a pretty long way. And so we're not exactly sure where the town is, so we're not sure exactly how long the forced march was, but it was a lot of men going a lot of way to protect Paul. Now, the foot soldiers are going to turn back at this point. The reason for that is they're moving out of the Judean hills into a flat plain. There's going to be very little chance of a surprise attack. Also, they're leaving the mostly Jewish area and moving into a mostly Gentile area because these coastal plains were controlled by the Philistines for a long time, and they became very Jewish intermingled. So it's a Jewish area, a Gentile area at this time, and so the chance of a surprise attack by Jewish insurrections would be very low. The cavalry stayed with Paul. The foot soldiers returned. The next day, they returned to the barracks, leaving the mounted men to go on with him. They, on reaching Caesarea, delivered the letter to the governor. The word here is procurator. Luke is very precise in his names for these Roman officials and local officials, which shows us the historicity. Palestine was an imperial province, and so it had a procurator. Now, notice where it says, and turned Paul over to him. He read the letter and asked Paul what province he was from. Now, the reason he asked Paul that was to see about the jurisdiction for his Roman legal case. Now, Paul said he was from Cilicia, which is also an imperial province. There were three kinds of province: imperial, controlled by the emperor; senatorial, controlled by the Senate; and under some kind of local control, like Herod the Great, and that kind of thing. So, when he found he was from Cilicia, that also is a Roman province, and he knew that he had jurisdiction. Verse 35, he said, I will carefully hear your case as soon as your accusers arrive. Then he ordered him to be kept in the custody in Herod's palace. Now, Herod's palace was a residence that Herod the Great had built for himself, a very lush place, which shows they dealt kindly with Paul, but it was still an imprisonment. Even imprisonment in a gilded cage is still imprisonment, and that's where he is until the accusers from Jerusalem show up. Now, in verse 24, they do, chapter 24. 5 days later. Now, we wonder if that's 5 days from Paul's arrest or 5 days from him leaving. We're not sure about the time sequence here. 5 days from some point just mentioned. The high priest Ananias. Now, this is the same man mentioned back in chapter 23:2. This is not the same Ananias that is in the Gospel of Luke. It's a different high priest by the same name. Came down with some of the elders. Now, the fact that the high priest came with some of the elders probably means a deputation from the Sanhedrin. This Supreme Court of the Jews, made up of 70 elders and leaders from the Jerusalem area, was the high court in both political and religious aspects for the Jewish people. It was made up of the Sadducee and high priest aristocracy, the Pharisee popular leaders, and then the older landed gentry of the town known as the elders. And so apparently a deputation comes with a prosecuting attorney named Tertullus. Now, Tertullus is a very common name. We're not sure if this man's Roman or Jewish or what. But it was very common in the provinces for a Roman lawyer who was used to Roman law, maybe even presented a case in Latin, to handle these cases, which the Sanhedrin would not be familiar with. Now, we learn this from Cicero's writing, Pro Cael, section 30. And you might want to see that. Now, through him, they presented their case against Paul before the governor. When Paul was called, notice this one, Your Excellency Felix. Now, Your Excellency is kind of a title. We find it quite often in the papyri used for Roman officials. Now, Felix is an interesting fella. I'm going to take just a minute to talk about him. He was a cruel man. One of the Roman historians, Tacitus, tells us that he reveled in cruelty and lust, and he reigned the exercise of a king with the mind of a slave. He's a cruel man. He got his position from his brother, P-A-L-L-A-S, Pallas, who was a freedman of Claudius's mother, Antonia. And it may be Felix, because his name also has a freedman's name connected with it. Maybe he was also a freedman. But this is the man at court that kept him in power. He got recalled once in A.D. 55, and we're not sure if his brother's influence got him off the hook. Apparently in A.D. 55, Nero took over and dispelled this man from his high position as the keeper of the treasury. But he was a very high man. That is Felix's brother. And that's who we have here. We find several references to Felix in the Annals of Tacitus, section 12, 54, in Josephus, Jewish Wars, book 2, chapter 12, 8 through chapter 13, 7, and Josephus, the Antiquities of the Jews, section 20, section 7, 1 through 8, 9. That's all in your outline, and you can see those historical allusions. Now, so Felix said, we'll hear you. So this Roman orator presents the case against Paul. We see in verses 4 through 6, there are three major charges. Number one, this guy's a disturber of the peace. Number two, he's a ringleader of this new Jewish sect called the Nazarenes. And number three, he tried to desecrate the temple. Now, it's very interesting to me as I read through the Gospel of Luke and Acts, how often Luke presents people before tribunals or officials. I think one of the major purposes of Luke writing Acts was to show that Christianity had not offended or broken Roman law, that every time it appeared before Roman justice, even though sometimes it was given injustice because of circumstances, there was no legal case against Christianity. And I think that's a real purpose of Acts. Now, this word, a perfect pest, is the word for pest or plague. We see it used in Luke 21:11. Now, then with the sect of the Nazarenes, the word sect, we get the English word heresy from that. Originally, it meant just to divide something. It's used of the Sadducees in Acts 5:17 and used of the Pharisees in Acts 15:5. So it does not have the ugly connotation that it does today in the English word heresy. It just meant a division of. And it's obvious from Paul's answer that he considers Christianity to be directly related to the faith and hope of the ancient people of God. He didn't see it as a schism or some kind of sect. He saw it as the fulfillment of the ancient promises. Now, this thing about him desecrating the temple, that was a religious charge. So was his being a pest. Of course, the Roman charge comes in the fact that he's causing trouble all over the world. And there was much misunderstanding about Jesus being called king. And some tried to say Jesus claims to be king, not Caesar. And that was what many people used to attack the early church. And it seems to be an implication here of which Felix would be very concerned with. Now, notice, if you would, where it mentions verse 9. The Jews also joined in charges and maintained that they were true. At the governor's signal, Paul answered. So they asked the lawyer to do it, but the Jews also kind of chimed in. Now, Paul's defense is called that in this verse 10, defense. We get the English word apology. It becomes a technical theological term for a defense of the faith, apologetics. So Paul's going to give his defense. And friends, he sees himself as faithful to the ancient promises of the Jewish people. Matter of fact, he says, it is true that I'm a member of the Way. Now, the Way is an ancient title for Christians. It emphasized two things, that Christianity was a lifestyle, and the Way is an Old Testament phrase to mean that God has clearly given us some paths to follow. Second, I think, it relates directly to who Jesus saw himself as in John 14:6. He said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but by me. They connected the person of Jesus and the ancient ways of God with this title. It's used extensively in Acts. Now, he's mentioned he continues to worship the God of his forefathers. And thus he mentions here, he believes everything taught in the law and the prophets. Now, the Law and the Prophets are two of the threefold division of the Hebrew canon. It's the Law, the Torah, the teachings of Moses, Genesis through Deuteronomy. Then it's the Prophets, which in the Hebrew canon would include Samuel and Kings and Chronicles and what you think of the Prophets. And then the Writings is the third section, which includes Daniel and Proverbs and Psalms and Ecclesiastes, wisdom literature and that kind of thing. So what he's saying is, I'm faithful to my understanding of the Old Testament Scriptures. He cherishes the hope. And notice he says, the hope they cherish, apparently making a gesture toward the Jewish group. But he's going to mention the resurrection. And of course we know that the Sadducees, the high priestly group, did not believe in the resurrection. But obviously there's a Pharisaic group that came with the deputation from the Sanhedrin. It's amazing as we look into this further, this is one of the major passages on the resurrection, not only of the righteous, but the wicked. And Paul affirms that. Josephus tells us in his Antiquities, book 18, section 1-3, that they didn't believe in the resurrection of the wicked, just of the righteous. But Paul asserts the resurrection of both. Now, there is much biblical precedent for that. Probably the first mention would be Daniel chapter 12, verse 2. You might want to see Matthew 25, 46. You might want to see John 5, 28 and 29. And then Revelation chapter 20, verses 11 through 15, assert the general resurrection of the dead. And that's what we're affirming here. So I'm always striving to have a conscience that is clear before God and men. Now, the same high priest who got so mad over that statement back in chapter 23, 1 and 2, Paul throws it right back in his teeth in this forum that he's not in control of. I came to bring a contribution of charity for my nation. Now, this idea of the contribution, it's funny it's not mentioned back in earlier in Acts, where it talks about the meeting with the elders of the Christian church and telling all that had happened in the Gentiles. The contribution is never mentioned. In the epistles of Paul, it is a very big deal. Especially Romans, it's mentioned. In 1 Corinthians, it's mentioned. In Galatians, it's mentioned about. This was an important fact that Paul was trying to bring the Gentile and Jewish churches together by getting the Gentile churches to help the poor of the Jerusalem church. But it's not mentioned at their meeting. Isn't that surprising? But it certainly is mentioned here. Now, Paul does make allusion it was for Jews, but of course it was for Jewish believers in Christ. That's what it was for. Now, he mentions that he was in the temple making sacrifice, and that he didn't have a great big mob around him or was causing trouble, but some Jews from Asia accused him. Paul makes a very important legal point when he says, where are those Jews that accuse me? Where are the ones that, first of all, started the riot? Why aren't they here? Now, that was a very good point, because, see, the eyewitnesses that accused Paul of causing trouble all over the world weren't even present. And I think the Roman procurator would take notice of that. By the way, I've forgotten something that I wanted to mention. I want to go back just for a minute and pick up something in your notes. If you've been following me in your translation, you realize that I left out several things back in the end of verse 6, all of verse 7, and the beginning of verse 8. That is an edition of the Western family of manuscripts. It first appears in the Codex Vizae, Codex D, and it got into the Textus Receptus, and therefore into the King James. But it's not in our earliest copy of the papyri, P74 here. It's not in Sinaiticus, it's not in Vaticanus, and it's not in Alexandrinus, Aleph A and B. Now, friends, with those four major ancient witnesses against this, there's no way that can be a regular part of the Scripture. And I wanted to mention to you why I didn't teach it when I was at that point. Excuse me for that digression. Let me come back now to the end when he mentions in verse 19 about these Asian Jews not being present. Then he says, if they have anything against me, this is a fourth-class conditional sentence, which is the farthest removed from potential action. He's saying, they don't have anything against me, but they should be here to present what they claim they do have, is the idea. Unless it is for one thing that I shouted out as I stood among them, it is for the resurrection of the dead that I am here on trial before you today. Now, what Paul is trying to do is answer a little bit about the confusion that broke out in the Sanhedrin when he was trying to give an defense. Now, he's saying, I have caused some disruptions, but it was not my fault. It's a theological matter. And since it's a theological matter between the Sadducees and the Pharisees of the Jewish sect, that has nothing to do with Roman law and Roman government, and Paul is as guiltless as he can be of any Roman crimes, and that's the tribunal which he's standing before, and so he should be acquitted. But then Festus, who had a fairly clear conception of the principles involved in the way. Now, how did he get these principles, and how exactly did he understand them? Well, he had been there for several years. There is some doubt about exactly when he came and left. Two Roman historians, Suetonius and Tacitus, disagree on when he came and left. But he'd been there several years and put down a lot of riots, had heard a lot of rumors. Maybe his Jewish wife knew something about it because she's going to be a daughter of one of the Herods, and they were very interested in Christianity. We don't know how the information he came to got to him, but he did have a correct understanding of some of the principles about the way. He adjourned the trial, saying to the Jews, "When Lysias, the colonel, comes here, I will carefully look into your case." He kind of dismisses it on the pretext of waiting till the Kiliarch from Jerusalem, who protected Paul, got him from the mob, and allowed him to speak, and took him before the Sanhedrin. When he came and fully explained his position, then Felix would make a judgment. Now, really, it seems like it's just a delaying tactic, for everything he needed was in that letter. He just wanted a way out. It was obvious that Paul was innocent, but these Roman procurators did not want to offend the Jewish leadership, and we see that all the way through these trials here. Now, he ordered the captain to keep Paul in custody, but to let him have freedom and not to prevent his friends from showing him kindness. Many of us believe that during this period, Paul had some money. He's going to appeal to Caesar, that costs money. Having his own house in Rome, that costs money. In just a minute, Felix is going to think he's going to maybe get a bribe from Paul. It has been speculated, I guess it started with Ramsey and Paul and his travels, that maybe Paul inherited some of his family money when he came back to Jerusalem in the connection with his nephew and his sister and all that. We're just not sure, but Paul apparently had some funds available. And so they're going to treat him very kindly, but he's still under house arrest, if you please. Verse 24. Some days later, Felix came with his wife, Drusilla. Now, Drusilla is an interesting young girl. At 16 years old, she had married very young, and at 16, she was still married to a king of a little Syrian province called Emesa, E-M-E-S-A. His name was Azizus, A-Z-I-Z-U-S. But at 16, she was lured away from her first husband to become the third wife of Felix. So at this time, she's probably about 20 years old. Now, she is the daughter of Herod Agrippa I and the full sister of Herod Agrippa II and Bernice. So she is very into the Herodian dynasty. You see something about her in Josephus, The Antiquities of the Jews, Book 19, Section 9, 1, and I think you can see something about her there. There are many Western additions to the text through here that implies that she is the one that was curious about talking to Paul, and that Paul's going to make her so mad that she's the one that got him kept in jail when Felix let most of the prisoners loose when his time of office changed down in verse 27. We can't be real sure of that. Came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewish, and sent for Paul and heard him talk about faith in Christ Jesus. Christ being the Greek title for the Hebrew Messiah, which means the Anointed One. And Jesus, of course, in Hebrew meaning Yahweh saves, but used by the authors of the New Testament to describe the humanity of Jesus. When the title goes together, it's an emphasis on who he is. And I think they would understand this title. Verse 25. But as he continued to talk about uprightness, self-control, and the coming judgment, Felix became alarmed and said, "For the present, you may go, and when I find a good opportunity, I will send for you." Wow. Friends, Paul didn't Mickey Mouse around the bush these Romans. He wanted to share who Jesus Christ was. But when he got in a private audience, he spoke right to the needs of these two people. Their self-control was lacking, and they were going to answer to God for the things they had done that was inappropriate to God's law. And Paul put the bite on them. And both of them got nervous and upset. We might even call it incipient conviction. Now, at verse 26, "But at that time he was hoping for money from Paul." That implies two things. It implies that we see the nature of Felix here as a Roman corrupt official. It also implies that Paul had some money. Now, where he got it, I don't know, but apparently he had some. So he kept on sending for him and talking with him. Now, did he talk because he was interested in Christianity, or did he talk hoping to get some money? Only the Lord knows the heart of this man. Verse 27. "But at the close of two whole years, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus." Now, many of us think that these two whole years that Luke was with Paul at his Caesarean imprisonment, that much of the eyewitness account of Luke's gospel came from this period. We think maybe he talked with Mary. He certainly talked with Philip and talked with many others of the eyewitnesses. The people he stayed with in Jerusalem, apparently Luke began to know and interview an early disciple. We don't think he wrote Luke at this time, but we think he gathered the information for Luke at this time. Now, at the end of this period, this man was relieved. Now, from history we know that his brother, P-A-L-L-A-S, Pallas, who was so friendly with Claudius, his mother, when Claudius was reign was over, Nero came to power, and he took this Felix's brother out of power. But the man was so wealthy because he controlled the treasury that we think he had great influence. In A.D. 55, there was a riot in Caesarea between the Syrian faction and the Jewish faction. Felix sent his troop against the Jewish faction, and he is recalled to Rome to give an account for that, and the Jews accused him there. We're not sure if he was acquitted or if he came back and was procurator for a few more years, because we are uncertain when Festus took over because of the discrepancy between Suetonius and Tacitus on this very point of history. Now, when we come here, we see that the general trend was that when a governor or procurator left, the prisoners who were being held but not convicted were released. Now, the Western text says that Felix left Paul in prison, and it adds a little phrase, because of Drusilla. Now, whether that's true or not, we're not sure. It's obvious they did not want to offend the Jewish leaderships, and Paul was caught in that. Now, beginning in chapter 25 is Paul's brief visit before the new procurator, Festus. Now, 3 days after his arrival, Festus went up from Caesarea. Notice you always go up to Jerusalem. So he came, he wanted to meet the leadership of his new province. He went up to Jerusalem, and the high priest and Jewish elders presented their charges against Paul. It shows the depth of their antagonism that after this many years, the first thing they brought up with a new leader was Paul the Apostle. Friend, Paul turned the world upside down, Jews and Gentiles, and these leaders wanted him dead. And that's why it's so priority to them. Festus wanted to please them, but he knew something was underfoot when they want them to bring Paul to Jerusalem. He said, no, I'm going back home in a few days. You just wait. We'll have a trial there. I think he's already getting suspicions, but he doesn't want to bias himself with these leaders. We learned from later on, I think about verse 6, there was a plot to kill him still underfoot, and these religious leaders, real moral guys, knew about it and were trying to plot his assassination. They begged the governor. Now, this is a strong verb here. It seems to imply over and over they asked him, but the governor wouldn't do it because they were plotting to ambush and kill him on the way. Those 40 guys who took an oath earlier not to eat, after 2 years, they're dead or they broke their oath. If we learned from the Sanhedrin, you could get out of one of those oaths. So their friends are the same ones. We're going to do it again. Festus answered that Paul was being kept in custody at Caesarea, and that he himself was going there soon. So have your influential men go down with me. Notice the go down. That is topological. Jerusalem is higher than Caesarea. But if you'll notice in Acts, it's always going down from Jerusalem and always going up too. Present charges against this man if there's anything wrong with him. Now, this is a first-class conditional sentence. Festus assumed that Paul was guilty of something for all this rigmarole and hullabaloo, but he doesn't know what, and he wants to hear the charges. After staying there not more than 8 or 10 days, he went down to Caesarea the next day. Next day, look at how fast this is happening. After taking his seat on the judge's bench, the bema, the official seat of the Roman judicial system, okay, he ordered Paul to be brought in. When he arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem surrounded him and made serious, heavy charges. If you look at Mult and Milligan, which gives us the background of Pyrrhi, they were blaming him for many things. Now, they did not have the lawyer with them again. They're going to be on their own this time. Probably the charges that the lawyer wrote in Latin were still on file, and they're just bringing the charges afresh. But boy, they came right to it, surrounded like a flock of bees. Paul continued to maintain in his defense that I've committed no offense against the Jewish law or temple or against the emperor. Now, the Roman official wasn't worth much about the Jewish law, but that he was causing riots and trouble around the kingdom, and that he was propagating a new king, all those were serious charges, and the emperor was interested in those. Then Festus, as he wanted to interrogate, to help himself be favored by the Jews, said to Paul, will you go up to Jerusalem and be tried on these charges before me there? And the before me there is emphatic. He wanted to say to Paul, who's a Roman citizen, I'm still in charge here, but let's go to Jerusalem and do it. And Paul says, Look at verse 10 through 11. There's been much discussion here by commentators. Some say that Paul did not really appeal to Caesar but that's what Festus picked up on to get the off the hot seat. Some say he was saying, I'm here in front of the rightful judge. I'm in the right place. This is the right court. You decide. But Luke understands him to say, I can't get any fairness from you. You know I'm innocent. You're trying to just hand me over to the Jews to win their favor. I appeal to Caesar. Now, there's a lot of discrepancy about this appealing to Caesar. It seems there were two ancient rights of Roman peoples that during the Republic, they could appeal to the people or to the Caesar or to a man at court who had the right to veto the local judicious person. But these became merged under the empire. And however it worked, we're not sure. But Paul had to pay the expense of the trip, pay the expense of his own home, room and board and all that. It was an expensive thing, but he had the legal right. Now, it didn't look good for Festus that his first big case got sent back to the headquarters at home. But he got him off the hot seat with the Jewish leaders, and I think he was glad to get out of it. Notice in verse 12, it says he conferred with the council. Now, this is not the Jewish high priesthood he's referring to. This is his legal Roman advisors, his court friends that he brought with him. They're going to talk it over, and he says, you've asked to see Caesar, to Caesar you'll go. Now, our next study of Acts will deal with one more defense before some Jewish folks before he leaves, and then Paul on his way to Rome. I think it's very interesting that we have seen Luke over and over maintain the innocence of Christianity in the Roman legal system. I think Luke and Acts were written to Gentiles to show that Christianity was not a troublemaking religion, that the charges against Christ were Jewish frauds, and that the arrest of Paul and the other apostles as the gospel moved out, like under Galileo and all of these guys, that they were dismissed because they had no legal merit in Roman law. That's a very important apologetic bias or structure of Luke and Acts. Well, I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again next time as we continue our study in Acts together.